This is Endocrine Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Hello, and welcome back to Endocrine Feedback Loop for our 34th episode. Today, we look at a recent paper from the JES that draws some novel conclusions about vitamin D's relationship to hypoparathyroidism following thyroid surgery. This study is another observational investigation, so we will do our usual careful consideration of the methodology to try to ensure that the conclusions drawn by the authors are well-founded. As is usually the case on the Endocrine Feedback Loop podcast, two excellent endocrinologists join me for this discussion. As a quick reminder, before I introduce them, I host this podcast and work at the Vanderbilt University Medical Center, where I see patients as a general endocrinologist, direct our outpatient endocrinology clinics, and serve as an associate director for our fellowship program. Returning today for, sadly, the last time as a regular contributor is Alan Dalkin. He comes to us from the University of Virginia, where his clinical career has specialized in calcium and bone metabolism during his long career. Importantly, he was the fellowship program director at UVA for many years, served on the residency review committee for the ACGME, and helped the Endocrine Society develop many educational products, particularly the Endocrine Self-Assessment Program. Our guest expert today is Suzanne Jondeboer. She hails from the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, where she directs the Clinical Research Unit Network of the Johns Hopkins Institute for Clinical and Translational Research. She is well known internationally for her clinical work and her basic and translational research, which focus on rare disorders of bone metabolism. You all, as our listeners, have likely heard her as an in-demand speaker and read the many impactful articles that she has published. So, as you can tell, I couldn't have asked for a better pair of endocrinologists to join me to help us understand this article. Also, as is always the case, everything we discuss will be our opinions only and not necessarily those of our respective institutions or the Endocrine Society. For this month's episode, we review Vitamin D Deficiency Reduces Post-Thyroidectomy Protracted Hypoparathyroidism Risk. Is gland preconditioning possible? The Journal of the Endocrine Society published this paper in January 2023. Lorena Martin-Roman served as the first author in collaboration with others, also from the Hospital General Universitario Gregorio Marañón in Madrid, Spain. Now I turn things over to Alan. He will review the author's introduction and, along with Suzanne, discuss some key concepts in this field. Alan?
Thank you, Chase. What I think I probably should start with is I'd like to sort of set up the article and the reason that they did the study in the first place. And that really relates to the notion of post-thyroidectomy or post-neck surgery hypoparathyroidism. They reviewed the literature, and there is a wide, wide range of incidence in this regard. They state somewhere between 7 and 51% of individuals have some degree of hypoparathyroidism after thyroidectomy, generally related to the extent of the surgery, also correlating with the skills of the surgeon, and a number of other factors that we'll touch on as we discuss the paper. I would say my experience here at the University of Virginia, we've been fortunate to have two and now three very skilled and experienced head and neck surgeons. I would say it's at the lower end of that, but I think that there are points that the authors made in terms of what things predict the higher probability of that as a downstream consequence of the surgery. Clearly, the more extensive the surgery, the bigger the thyroid cancer, neck dissection and such all do correlate with that. But I'd say experientially, I'm probably more familiar with a 10 to 20% incidence, maybe closer to the 10%. The other bits of background that they brought forth before they introduced their research protocol was that there are a lot of different articles that really try to address improved surgical technique, things that you can do to identify higher risk patients, not so much what are the things that one can do before surgery to prevent it from happening in the first place. And in our world, really generally speaking, we try to make sure that people are vitamin D replete, that the surgeon knows exactly what they're going to be doing, that the anesthesia and the operative risk is minimized, and all those things. And there really hasn't been much of an effort made to say, what are the approaches that we could do, whether intuitive or counterintuitive, as might be the case here, that would help minimize the patient's long-term or even short to midterm issues after their surgery. So what they had proposed was that potentially by having vitamin D deficiency. We'll get into the degree to which that would be the case in a bit. That would lead to secondary hyperparathyroidism, which might predispose the patients to have more hardy, more durable, more resistant parathyroid glands to the potential negative sequelae of a thyroidectomy and surgery, where they could be damaged because of vascular problems or because of contact with the surgery itself, things like that. So that generally led the authors to the project that they report here. So first of all, I'd like to find out from Suzanne, what's the Hopkins experience in terms of the risk of hypocalcemia and hypoparathyroidism after a thyroidectomy? And what's been your general approach to the patients getting them ready for that procedure?
Yeah, well, thank you, Alan. My experience has been very similar to your experience because we have several very experienced thyroid and parathyroid surgeries that this is almost the exclusive thing that they do in their surgical careers. We have good outcomes at Hopkins. I would say we have less than 1% incidence of permanent surgical hypoparathyroidism. And I would say that in the literature, it looks like around 20 to 25% of transient is where we land. And I think we're well below that. So that's been my experience at Hopkins. And I agree with you as well. When I'm thinking about sending someone to thyroid surgery or parathyroid surgery, I want to make sure that they are vitamin D sufficient to reduce the risk of postoperative hypoparathyroidism, postoperative hypocalcemia. And I want to make sure that I'm communicating with the surgeon as to the type of surgery that's going to be done.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the notion of when Chase and I were looking for articles to review for this, the notion that hypoparathyroidism would be prevented by hypovitaminosis D really struck me as an odd thought in the first place. And that's what attracted me to read the article and to explore the nuances thereof. So I agree. I would never have considered that hypovitaminosis D, vitamin D deficiency in any form, whether it's mild, moderate, or severe, would be a good thing. So we would historically have replaced these individuals. And my part, and then I'll turn it back over to Chase by saying that the primary aim on this was to determine whether there was a correlation between vitamin D deficiency and either the degree or duration of hypoparathyroidism after thyroidectomy. And they also had a secondary aim of trying to identify some other factors that might be correlative in terms of the risk of hypocalcemia and hypoparathyroidism. That sort of gets to the study design, and I will turn it over to Chase.
Good, thanks, Alan. And I think one of the things that we'll want to think about is really think about our terms and what we mean with different things as we go along. So I agree. I think the aims are a good one, and Alan has outlined those for us. I'd say in the introduction, the authors also state a hypothesis, and there they suggest that parathyroid gland hyperplasia conditioned by vitamin D deficiency could condition a faster parathyroid function recovery in these post-thyroidectomy patients with hypoparathyroidism. And so I think we'll want to keep that in mind. This isn't a study to really look at hyperplasia. They use other markers that could be related to that. So I think we, as we go along, and we'll walk through this in methods in particular, but we really want to think carefully about when we say hyperplasia and hypoparathyroidism and vitamin D deficiency and hypocalcemia. So those are not all the same things. There are going to be a lot of overlap there, obviously, and then a lot of them are going to cause the other one, but those are distinct, and we can't be careful to, we have to be careful not to assume that one necessarily means the other. So, okay. So now let's get into the methods and really start thinking about that. So first of all, what we're going to do is we'll look at a study design here. Alan mentioned that we're going to take a look at that. So this is a retrospective cohort study. So we're going to do our usual. We're going to take a step back. Actually, we've looked at quite a few retrospective cohort studies in this podcast series of late, but we'll still, I think it's helpful to review what we mean when we say that. So a cohort study, what that is it takes a cohort, a group of subjects, a group of patients. And in this situation, Alan's already mentioned it, but these are going to be individuals who have undergone a total thyroidectomy. So that's our cohort. That's our overall group. And then what it does, cohort studies then split that cohort into smaller groups, into subgroups. And those groups are defined by different exposures. And we'll talk about how they did this here, but usually it's you had an exposure or you didn't have an exposure. And then what you do is you follow those individuals over time to see if one group has more frequent occurrence of an outcome than the other group does. So that time component's key. That's one of the key aspects of a cohort study. And then the retrospective, that indicates that the study was started after all of the data has been collected. So the opposite of this is a prospective study. In prospective studies, you are following these individuals in real time. So you start the study before an outcome has happened, and you're following along with them, waiting for an outcome to develop or not develop. Retrospective studies like this one, it's all over. You're usually going back. Often these are database studies, or you're doing a chart review, as this was the case here, to find outcomes that have already occurred. So that's what this is. Now, one key thing that we have to keep in mind are different biases. And this is always happens whenever you have an observational study. You have to be worried about biases that is baked into these types of study designs. And in particular here, I think it's helpful to review performance and ascertainment biases. And what those are very much hinged on knowing which group somebody's in. The strength of clinical trials, blinded clinical trials, is that you don't know whether somebody is in a treatment group or not in a treatment group. And so you can't treat them differently. Observational studies are very different. Almost always the providers involved know what group somebody's in. Now, they don't know that they're in a study, particularly with a retrospective cohort study. You have no idea that what you're doing as clinical care is one day going to be a part of a study. But potentially, if you know someone's exposure, in this case, we're going to be thinking about vitamin D, if you know what that is, you may be treating somebody differently. And also the subjects themselves may be doing something different based on that. So that's performance bias. And then ascertainment bias is you actually may be looking for outcomes differently in that situation. With clinical care, this is very appropriate. So it's not anything wrong that you do, but it does cause problems when you're trying to investigate this and understand the connection between an exposure and an outcome. So we're going to think about those as we dive into this study. Okay, now we're ready for this one. So this study is a retrospective cohort study. It comes from a single institution. I mentioned it already, in Madrid, Spain. And the data comes from May 2014 through June 2019. So the inclusion criteria for this, they're very broad, which I think was good, is that these are adults undergoing a total thyroidectomy. And you were included really if you had your final pathology was available and you had at least a year of follow-up data available. So fairly broad inclusion criteria. And then similarly, I think another strength of this study is that the exclusion criteria were fairly limited. They appropriately, because they're going to look at calcium and parathyroid issues here, so they excluded any individuals who had a condition, an underlying condition that might affect the calcium or phosphate metabolism, but otherwise fairly minimal exclusion criteria here. Okay, so now we're going to slow down. I'm going to go through a few of how the authors describe, or what the authors describe as procedure. So a couple comments here along the way that the authors make. So first of all, they point out that in their clinical care, chemistries and intact PTH levels were routinely obtained. So that's why they were able to analyze these, because they have so much of that. They point out that they use three experienced endocrine surgeons. Alan and Suzanne have already talked about how important that is. So the authors appropriately tell us we had just three folks and they're very experienced at what they do. And additionally, they defined, or they described, when hypoparathyroidism treatment was started. So there were a couple of different situations to where after a total thyroidectomy, these surgeons would treat for hypoparathyroidism. The first one was as if there was a significant change in the PTH level from before to after the surgery. And then also, if you had low PTH levels the day after surgery. So a little bit more comment on that in a second. We're going to really try to tease these out. But that change, so that pre-op to post-op change in PTH, if that was more than 70%, that was a trigger for treatment of hypoparathyroidism. And then also if your PTH was 14 or less on post-op day one. So we're going to come back to that here in just a second. So that's when they treated. So the treatment, when they decided to do it, it was based on calcium and calcitriol replacement. And in particular, the calcium replacement was calcium carbonate, 1 gram, 3 times daily. And the calcitriol, however, that dose was based on what the authors describe as the risk for hypoparathyroidism. And I would point out here that it was unclear to me, at least, what determined that risk. And this was the rationale for mentioning a performance bias before, is it's possible that the way that these providers determine risk was based on what's going to be looked at as an exposure. So it's really unclear. I don't know exactly how they decided what dose to use based on the particulars of this risk, but that's something that we're going to have to keep in mind here. And then finally, as far as the procedures, the monitoring. So this was fairly standard. And so I think this is alleviate some of the concerns about an ascertainment bias. But in particular, calcium and PTH levels were checked weekly for that first month after surgery, and then periodically, so a little less clear there. But the trigger for stopping treatment was if both your PTH and your calcium were normal, then your treatment was stopped. Okay, definitions, and this is where we're really going to try to get in the weeds here. So in particular, hypoparathyroidism. There were two ways that you could be diagnosed with hypoparathyroidism, and they've got some subsets in here. I'm going to come back to those in a second. But first of all, just the definition itself. So if your PTH was less than 15, or if you needed treatment for hypoparathyroidism. So now I want to stop and I want to get Suzanne and Alan's input. We'll start with Suzanne here. So Suzanne, give us your thoughts on this. I kept coming back to this. I mentioned it before, as we've got a bunch of things that overlap but are different, is hypoparathyroidism doesn't always mean the same thing as hypocalcemia. But here, where the authors are presenting data, presenting these results with a PTH, but not with a corresponding calcium. So so help me understand that. What are your thoughts on that in particular, and how that could lead to implications for who got treated?
Yeah, that struck me as odd too, because usually I use the PTH and the calcium together. So here they're defining hypoparathyroidism as a low PTH. Their assay measured PTH from 14 to 72. And if their PTH was lower than 14, which is the lower limit of their assay, they defined that as hypoparathyroidism, but did not interpret it in the setting of the calcium. So you could be normal calcemic with a PTH that's below the normal range and be called hypoparathyroid. And that's not necessarily how we would define it clinically. So clinically, I would define hypoparathyroidism, hypocalcemia, also in the face of a low PTH or an inappropriately normal PTH for the level of hypocalcemia. I thought that was a little bit unusual, just to have a PTH caught off without any respect to hypocalcemia, symptoms of hypocalcemia, or other measures.
Alan, comments on that?
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I do think that the degree of hypocalcemia matters as well in terms of replacement. In other words, that calcium replacement is relatively benign, although admittedly in patients with hypoparathyroidism, there can be quite a bit of hypercalciuria because there's no PTH to initiate urinary resorption. But still, the downside is pretty small. The calcitriol becomes a bigger issue. And generally, I would want to see true hypocalcemia or at least symptoms of hypocalcemia. Some people tend to be symptomatic at different levels. It's between albumin and ionized calcium. It's sometimes hard to interpret just a chemistry basic panel. But the gist of it is that you'd want to see a calcium level before you called somebody hypoparathyroid to the point of needing calcitriol therapy. So I'm not sure that the PTH level, which may be low for a short period of time, is going to necessarily do that. I completely agree with both of you.
I think that's helpful, and where my mind went initially was, so you guys were both talking about that initial, that post-op day one. Where I went initially with that is I sometimes see that we have surgeons who get worried about this possibility for one reason or another, and I'll say for this paper's purposes, maybe because somebody had vitamin D deficiency, and perhaps get a little bit too aggressive with calcium and calcitriol. And if you give people too much of that, then you may suppress it, but if you actually check the calcium, it would be high, and that's not really what we're talking about. Yes, the PTH is low, but it's not really hypoparathyroidism, at least not in the iatrogenic sense here. So that was another potential place where this could show up as an issue here.
I mean, it may certainly be someone you would want to watch closely or measure calcium more frequently if you're worried that they were trending down to have a low PTH like that. But I agree with you that it needs to be interpreted with the calcium level.
I have a feeling that maybe a better way to phrase this, there's a rational basis for the post-op day one parathyroid level being important, but it's not necessarily in this condition. In patients that have primary hyperparathyroidism, there's definitely a correlation between post-op day one PTH levels and surgical cure from their hyperparathyroidism, as well as the risk of developing hypoparathyroidism and hypocalcemia. But this is a different bird. So I'm not so sure it's exactly the parallel universe. In that situation, at least in part, the theory is that there's some degree of uninvolved parathyroid gland suppression from the overactive adenoma, presumably, and then there'll be sort of short-term recovery in that regard. So the PTH level on day one is something we routinely check, you know, day after surgery. But in here, I just don't know that it confers the exact same meaning, but I bet that's where the day one PTH testing idea came from.
All right. So to get back to the definitions here, so we talked about hypoparathyroidism. They define different time periods. So if somebody had hypoparathyroidism that persisted for more than a year, that was considered definite hypoparathyroidism. There was a way that you could be diagnosed with transient. They have a couple different groups within that subgroup. So if you recovered within 30 days from transient hypoparathyroidism, that was considered early recovery. If it took longer, so you still recovered within a year, but it took you more than 30 days to recover, then that was a protracted recovery. So a few different definitions here. Alan's going to walk us through those in a second. And then finally, to wrap up the methods here, as far as vitamin D deficiency goes, there's a couple of cutoffs that they use. You were considered deficient if your vitamin D level was less than 20 nanograms per mil, and then you had a severe deficiency if you were less than 10 nanograms per mil. So before we wrap up here, I'll just ask Suzanne for your thoughts on a couple different things. One, just on the cutoffs, but then also say that the authors made a mention in this section that they didn't routinely replace folks if they were found to have a deficiency. I thought that was interesting. You all have both mentioned a different approach that you would use there, and I think that it has direct implications here. So comment, Suzanne, from you before we move on from the method section.
Yeah, so I do think that a year where you're having hypocalcemia and needing and having low PTH and needing calcium and calcitriol supplements, I think that's reasonable to call that permanent hypoparathyroidism. Although it was interesting to note that, you know, 3/4 of their people that were deemed having permanent hypoparathyroidism eventually recovered. But I do think it's a little bit arbitrary to take the transient and break them up into early recovery of less than 30 days and greater than 30 days. And I'm not quite sure where those definitions came from or what physiologic basis they were based on. So that's a little unclear to me. As far as the vitamin D deficiency definitions, you know, there's controversy around this, but certainly in a population where you're not concerned with bone health, you could say that less than 20 nanogram per ml is deficient and less than 10 is severe deficiency. What I did notice is they didn't comment on anybody being on supplements or replacement here. And this was a largely female group in their mid-50s. So, you know, it's conceivable that people could have been on supplementation. So I think that the definitions here are fine. It's just very murky as to who was being supplemented and who wasn't being supplemented.
All right, important things for us to keep in mind. I'm going to turn everything over to Alan now. So he's going to walk us through the results. We're going to keep all this methodology in mind, and then we'll circle back to it in the discussion afterwards. But first, Alan, walk us through the results.
All right, thanks, Jay. So generally speaking, of the medical charts that they reviewed, the inclusion criteria and all that, they found 397 patients that met the criteria to be entered into the study. Of those, most of them, 82%, were women, and the average age was in the mid-50s, 56-year-old range, which gets at what Suzanne was discussing just a moment ago. The vast majority of those patients had a single thyroidectomy surgery. About 2/3 of those surgeries were for benign disease, and 1/3 were for malignant disease. So some of them with thyroid malignancy had a more extensive surgery, including neck dissection and lymph node removal. Of those 397 patients, 374 of them had a preoperative vitamin D level that was measured, and the patients are stratified in that regard, or at least quantified in that regard. Of the 374 patients, 43% of them met their criteria of deficiency, that is less than 20. And of those patients that had vitamin D deficiency, there was a trend or a higher level of PTH in those individuals. I would make a comment here that one of my concerns about this is that even in the patients that had low vitamin D levels, the PTH levels, while higher than those that did not have low vitamin D, the PTH levels in those individuals were not above the normal range. They were still within the reference range. So there was no evidence of secondary hyperparathyroidism in the majority of those individuals.
And Alan, I would chime in here because I think this gets back to some of the ideas that the authors, and they describe it as speculation, but wondering about the possibility for hyperplasia. I do think you have to worry about how far down you're getting here is if you're saying, well, you do identify vitamin D deficiency, but at least with median values, those folks don't have a hyperparathyroidism. It's even then further removed to infer that there's hyperplasia in all of these individuals when you don't have anything that clearly suggests that. So I think that's another thing we'll want to keep in mind. Again, we'll get back to that in the discussion as well.
That is probably the critical point of the whole analysis of the article. So of the 397 patients that were evaluated in the study, and this is in figure one, so as you're looking through the article, you can take a look at that. Of those, 245 patients had no evidence of postoperative hypoparathyroidism, and those serve as the reference group for those individuals that do have, by their criteria, postoperative hypoparathyroidism. So 152 individuals did meet the criteria for that. And of those 152 individuals, transient hypoparathyroidism, which resolves within 1 year's time, that was the majority of those individuals, 131, and 21 individuals at least the 1 year time point had not resolved in terms of their hypoparathyroidism. Of the 21, the majority of those eventually do. They had followed up charts on these individuals, followed up visits that went on for a period of time after the 1 year. But for the definitions that Chase went through in this study, the 1 year interval was considered to be that of definitive or chronic hypoparathyroidism. And so there's 21 individuals there. Then of the 131 individuals in which their hypoparathyroidism resolved, they split those, or they broke out into two groups, those that resolved at 30 days. And I would make a comment here. I agree with Chase. I have no idea, or Suzanne, I have no idea what specifically is magical about 30 days, but other than that, it's a calendar month. But still, they had 70 of those patients resolve within the 30-day timeframe, and then the other 61 took between 1 month and 12 months to have resolution of their hypoparathyroidism. The interesting part as it relates to the data is that when the authors compared the vitamin D levels in those first two groups, those that did not experience hypoparathyroidism postoperative versus those that did, there is no difference in the vitamin D levels. It was only when you broke it down into the subset, which is comparing the early recovery patients, those with the hypoparathyroidism that lasted less than 30 days, to those that were the later responders or later recovery individuals between 30 and 365 days, that there is a difference in the vitamin D levels. Although again, even between those two groups, the PTH levels are not elevated preoperatively in either of those sets. So of the people that recovered, 53% recover within the first 30 days. So in their experience, even individuals that have post-thyroidectomy hypoparathyroidism, you can expect either no problem, which would be in two-thirds of the individuals, or of those with the problem, more than half of those respond and recover pretty quickly. So I think that sums up the majority of the data, but I do think that sort of teasing out the vitamin D, PTH levels, and this issue of whether there really was the stimulus and the response to that stimulus before surgery is where we should lead the discussion going forward.
Thanks, Alan. So we'll start with where the authors start, and they describe their results. First of all, they say that based on a definition of hypoparathyroidism, quote, strictly set, end quote, at PTH less than 14 at 24 hours, transient hypoparathyroidism occurred 33% of the time. And I don't want to overly harp on anything, but I will point out the authors specifically use the phrase strictly set, and yet in their definitions, there was a broader definition of what was considered hypoparathyroidism. It could include a PTH less than 14 at post-op day one, but it could also include the need for treatment, which wasn't defined there. So I would quibble with strictly set when that does not match with the definition that the authors used earlier. But still, with that definition, 33% of the time, hypoparathyroidism, transient hypoparathyroidism was present. The authors point out that in their series, malignancy and combining a total thyroidectomy with a lymphadenectomy were risk factors for hypoparathyroidism. And they also point out that this has been described in the medical literature before. They also, in comparing their results to the medical literature, point out that in the past, that vitamin D deficiency has been shown to be a risk factor for hypocalcemia. And again, I'll point out here that we have to be careful that does not necessarily mean hypoparathyroidism, particularly with vitamin D deficiency. And so it's unclear how much of that is applicable to what the authors are finding in their results. Next, something else that the authors point out, we've talked about this already, but they do say that there is not an association between vitamin D deficiency and the risk of hypoparathyroidism. We've already talked about this before, so I don't know that we need to go back to that, but I do think it at least calls into question then what the importance is in the subset of individuals with transient hypoparathyroidism if there isn't an association seen in general with vitamin D deficiency and risk of hypoparathyroidism. And then finally, and I think this is a real key thing, and the authors certainly describe this as a speculation, but they do speculate that faster recovery from transient hypoparathyroidism in those with vitamin D deficiency might be from parathyroid gland hyperplasia serving as organ preconditioning. And so I do want to get Alan and Suzanne's thoughts on this in a second here. I'll go back to Alan on this, but the authors do a nice job. They pull in other literature talking about preconditioning of other organs, and this is an important concept to get into when you're looking at observational literature. It's one of the Hill criteria. And do you have an analogy? Is this something that happens elsewhere? And then it does strengthen your argument if you can show that that's the case. So the authors do a good job of doing that. But Alan, why don't you expand on that just a little bit more? You mentioned that already, but what are your thoughts on the speculation from the authors that this organ preconditioning may be a key factor here?
I think it certainly is a reasonable possibility. I mean, it's a plausible hypothesis in that regard. I think that in patients with chronic kidney disease and secondary hyperparathyroidism because of hyperphosphatemia, it's very common to see hyperplasia of all four parathyroid glands or some fraction of four. On the other hand, generally speaking, at least the thought is that there's a correlation between the duration of secondary hyperparathyroidism of diminished renal function and the development of that hyperplasia. In other words, it does not occur overnight. It is, first of all, an acute renal failure. Oftentimes the PTH levels don't go up that much. And second of all, that even in people with renal failure that's weeks to months in duration, it's not necessarily going to result in marked secondary hyperparathyroidism and parathyroid-related bone changes. So one of the limitations, in my opinion, of this study was there was no effort made to categorize the duration of hypovitaminosis D or vitamin D deficiency before the surgery, because I would suspect that in people that have had more chronic conditions, this may be more likely. And in people with more recent vitamin D deficiency or mild vitamin D deficiency, it would seem implausible to me. It would seem unlikely.
All right, Suzanne, give us your thoughts. You think of a lot about parathyroid stuff, both routine parathyroid disorders and more exotic ones. So from your perspective and your understanding of parathyroid gland physiology and pathophysiology, what are your thoughts on this possible mechanism?
Yeah, you know, I agree with Alan. It really depends on the severity and the chronicity of the stimulus to the parathyroid glands. He points out that chronic kidney disease is one of those stimuli and chronic vitamin D deficiency as well. But again, we don't have any information about even how long before the surgery these vitamin D levels were measured. So we don't have an idea about the chronicity of the vitamin D deficiency, you know, and usually it's in the setting of severe vitamin D deficiency with accompanying osteomalacia, you know, things that have been going on for a long period of time. So I agree with Alan. I'm a bit skeptical with normal parathyroid levels at baseline without description of ongoing stimulus to cause chronic overstimulation of the parathyroids, I would be hard-pressed to say that this was parathyroid hyperplasia that we were seeing.
Thank you. That's helpful. And I do think, and the authors do describe and discuss their limitations, and they do point out that this is a retrospective study. And we'll take a step back just again to think about study design. I think this really well illustrates if you were designing a prospective study and you had total control over measurement of both exposures and outcomes, this is probably something that you would try to figure out a little bit more. So I think this well illustrates that with retrospective cohort studies, you are at the mercy of what data you have. And if you don't have the data, then you're just stuck trying to make the best of it. And the authors do point that out. That's a limitation. So they're very upfront about that and not having all the information that they would like to have if they had their choice. They do also point out that study is relatively small. They discuss an inability to stratify their patients based on hypoparathyroidism risk status, though that remains a little unclear to me exactly what they meant by that. And then finally, they point out that they did use immunoassays for measuring vitamin D and so may not be quite as accurate as other methodologies in the lab. So finally, we'll go to the author's conclusions, and then we're going to think about that a little bit more. So the way that they summarize their findings, they state that preoperative vitamin D deficiency could act as a parathyroid gland preconditioning factor. And then their recommendation based on that is that they would suggest that we need an RCT of those with vitamin D deficiency preoperatively, evaluating the effects of vitamin D supplementation in addition to more observational and basic science studies. So we'll think about things a little bit more. Let's start with just an evaluation of the study overall. So, Alan, why don't we get your thoughts on that? What are your impressions on just the quality of this report overall?
as I said, I think it's an interesting hypothesis, and it does have some potential, in my opinion, although I don't know how you would render somebody vitamin D deficient before thyroidectomy for thyroid cancer. In other words, you're not going to wait 6 months or 12 months to do their surgery until their vitamin D levels drift down by, you know, keeping them in the closet and not allowing them any supplements. So I think from a technical point of view, I'm not necessarily sure how you could recreate the physiology and pathophysiology that they're interested in studying. The second part of it is I was a little bit left wanting in that if they had gone back and looked at the pathology of the parathyroid glands in the patients where the surgical specimens had those parathyroid glands available. This was not particularly historically driven. I mean, it was within recent history, I should say. You could have potentially gone back to look at any of the parathyroid glands to see if there's any evidence of hyperplasia in what tissue you have. The hypothesis here is that it's a systemic stimulus. That is, that all four parathyroid glands would see the same level of vitamin D and have the same drive in terms of secondary hyperparathyroidism. So even if there's only one parathyroid gland in the surgical specimen and that the other three are working for different mechanisms, you could still go back and look in those individuals and see whether there was evidence of histologic change that's compatible with the hypothesis, that fits the hypothesis. So I like the idea. I don't know how I'd get to that as a pre-op plan. I think they could have gone a little further in terms of looking at ways to potentially either support or refute the hypothesis, prove or disprove the hypothesis by some of the other tissue sample stuff that they had.
Good, Alan, that's helpful. And I agree with your comments on their recommendation on RCT. I think while that information might be helpful, an RCT like they described would help you figure out if vitamin D supplementation would help avoid hypocalcemia or hypoparathyroidism post-op. I don't know that it would actually tell you if vitamin D deficiency acts as a parathyroid gland preconditioning factor, though it might. Suzanne, give us your thoughts, just the quality of this report overall.
Well, I mean, I think I could offer an alternative hypothesis. I mean, the alternative hypothesis might be that people with vitamin D deficiency postoperatively, if they have transient hypoparathyroidism, might be the ones that would require a higher dose of calcitriol, or might be the ones that are symptomatic, that the PTHs didn't necessarily fall below the normal range, that might then need more treatment. And then by having more treatment, have less stimulus for recovery of the parathyroids. So I think there's an opportunity for an alternative hypothesis. It seems to me that they had a lot of access to post-operative PTHs, and should have had access to post-operative calcium levels. And I would really like to have seen those calcium levels. I think that would help us put the hypothesis into greater context to understand if the gland preconditioning was what was causing the difference in the recovery in these two groups of transient hypoparathyroidism.
Yeah, I don't like your description of that alternate hypothesis. It's a good example of a performance bias, is if you know that somebody has a vitamin D deficiency, then maybe you have a much more sensitive trigger to put them on replacement, and then that would cause them to be defined as having hypoparathyroidism when it was really just your knowledge of their vitamin D deficiency that was the driver there, not necessarily the vitamin D deficiency in and of itself. Okay, so Suzanne, we will wrap up things with you. So just give us your thoughts. And I'd say the authors don't necessarily call for us to change our practice here at all. So they're not advocating for that. But what, if any, information would you see here that might potentially affect the way that you treat patients in this situation?
I think that, you know, just having some idea of what the one-day postoperative PTH is would give you an idea of how closely you need to watch these individuals for the development of hypoparathyroidism. Alan brought out a great point about, you know, the vast majority of these individuals do not become hypopara, do not get hypocalcemia, and they recover. So this is also good information for patients when you're discussing the risks of surgery.
And with that, I would like to thank Alan Dahlken and Suzanne Gendebert for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I hope you all learned as much as I did today, and please join us again next month. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of the Endocrine Society, with production oversight by Brandy Brown and Andrew Harmon.